The Late Debate with Katie Hannan on RTE Radio 1.
Ahead of target or a glacial pace, we analyse the latest social housing figures. Is there a gap in the political market for a new Conservative Party? And will rural Ireland ever get high-speed broadband? All that and more in tonight's Late Debate, but first the news with Tommy Mescal. Good evening and welcome to the Late Debate. I'm Katie Hannan, and joining us tonight we have Eamon Ryan, leader of the Green Party and TD for Dublin Bay South, Padraig Tobin, leader of the New Party Éin Thú and TD for Meath West, Elaine Loughlin, political reporter with the Irish Examiner, Mary C. Murphy, political scientist with the Department of Government and Politics in UCC, Deirdre Duffy, human rights lawyer and Fine Gael general election candidate, and Rory Hearn, social policy lecturer with Maynooth University. We want to hear from you, so do get in touch. You can text us on 51551, email us on latedebate@rte.ie or tweet to @latedebaterte. Now, just over 4,000 social houses were built last year, while the public purse contributed €400 million in housing assistance payments to renters in need. Today on Morning Ireland, Minister for Housing Owen Murphy insisted that the government is making progress in dealing with the housing crisis.
Overall, the increase in our social housing stock was 8,400 new homes last year across the country. So that's 8,400 families and individuals getting to move into a home, get their own keys with their families. I met a lot of them. Very important progress for those thousands of families. But we know that there are thousands more who need our help. And that's what we are doing through Rebuilding Ireland, through our local authorities, is dramatically increasing the number of new built social housing homes. And just to put that in context, every home that was built last year, one in four was for social housing. Now, people who are on the housing lists or in emergency accommodation are those who are most vulnerable. It's a relatively small cohort, it's less than 100,000. And yet, one in four of new homes built last year was for social housing, and that's right.
Deirdre Duffy, the Minister, sounding fairly pleased with himself there in terms of the numbers he was announcing this morning. Should he be?
Yes, I think we should be pleased the progress is being made. I think the government is in agreement, and everyone around this table knows that this is not going to be a quick fix solution, that this is going to take time. But we're moving in the right direction. This is working and things are changing. Would we like to see a quicker change? Yes, absolutely. But it takes time to fix a system that has been broken over many, many years. And he did mention the number there of 8,000 people rehomed into social housing. There are other things going on as well. Obviously, the HAP system is, even though it's a temporary measure, it is working. It is effective for people.
But it's effective. Can I just ask you about the HAP system? Because I think the figures that emerged today in relation to HAP are really quite staggering. There's 400 million in HAP. I understand there's another 80 or something or so million in rental assistance payments. We're approaching €500 million, which is just going into support into landlords' pockets, basically, in order to keep a roof over the heads of a staggering number of people. And what is that doing to the rest of the housing market and the rental market?
The HAP system is a temporary measure. It's not a long-term solution. But, I mean, it's taking people off the streets, off homelessness accommodation, and it's giving them a home. And there is also, the government does recoup some of that money in tax. So the net cost is actually half of what it would be. So let's say if it's 14,000 in rent, then 700 is actually the net cost. Nobody's saying that this can happen forever, and we need to move into more longer-term solutions, like the Land Development Agency, which is looking now to use state lands to build new density communities, which are more than just homes, which are, of course, extremely important, but are also looking at things like services, like community facilities, like green space, like playing fields. We also need to do other things, Katie, and I just finished on this point. For example, in my own constituency in Dublin Central, I see that there's a lot of vacant houses because of the Fair Deal system, which is really good and it's working really well. But the numbers in that as well, if you look at them, if you look at like 13,000 people on Fair Deal, and then the staggering low numbers of people who are actually renting out those vacant homes, which is about 600. So we need to make it more suitable for people who do want to rent out their homes to be able to do so under that system, to get the stock moving so that people, families, individuals can rent.
Why isn't that done? I appreciate you're not a government representative. Yes, you hope to be, obviously. Sure. But when you hear words like we need to, we should be, we are so far down the road and the scale of this is so enormous. It seems extraordinary that we're still at the we should, we need.
But we're moving. It is being reviewed. And I absolutely take your point. I'm frustrated with it as well. And other people are too. but it is moving.
See, the problem is Fine Gael has been in government for 8 years. If you remove the future tense from Fine Gael's conversation around this, they have very little to say. So we know that we need about 36,000 houses a year, yet we know that last year about 18,000 houses were built in total. So we know we're still miles away from, you know, even just meeting demands, never mind actually making an indent into the 72,000 families who are on the waiting lists currently. And that adds up to about 250,000 people, because each one of those has as a family. Now, last year, 2,200 houses were built by local authorities. That works an average of 60 houses per local authority last year in the teeth of a humanitarian crisis. And the interesting thing about this, it is a humanitarian crisis, but it's having massive knock-on effects in society, because the house inflation is leading to wage demands, which are leading to the crisis that we see in amongst nurses, and the lack of competition now that's creeping into the economy. This housing crisis, 10 years from the last, is having a radical effect on the health of our economy, never mind the actual humanitarian crisis there. And yet we don't see the ambition necessary with regards to social housing built as of yet. There needs to be more money put into that. There also needs to be a fix with regards to planning applications so the process can go faster. You have big developers right now sitting on massive plots of land because they know that the price is going up every year. And yet the governments since 2015 have been talking about a vacant site tax that is marginally implemented this year, and it isn't the stick necessary to motivate big developers to actually get that land into development.
Eamon Ryan.
I think, but that I agree with Pather, but I think there's also a wider, bigger problem. Deirdre said that, you know, we have to fix a system that's broken, but we're not doing that. We're going back to the old ways. One of the things we should be doing is developing what's called a new model of cost rental housing. And that's public housing. It's land where housing which is owned by the public, which is rented out. The rent covers the cost of building it. You plan for 20, 30 years. In doing that, you give people security in the rental system. And rather than giving 400 million just to the private landowners, as you say, you should put that money into building those type of rental accommodation, because that actually brings down the price of rental for everyone.
Can I ask you, because I know that you have been proposing this and promoting this idea for some time now. Mm. Why do you think, because it does on paper seemed to make sense.
It was
why do you think the reluctance
the Dáil, it was supported
there is
the
reluctance
Dáil by everyone except Fine Gael, even though it's in the government's own programme for government, they say they want to do it. And every time I talk to Owen Murphy, says, oh yeah, we want to do it. They're doing one scheme. It's supported by Social Justice Ireland. It's very progressive. And you get over some of the downsides or the problems we've had in social housing in the past. It's not, you create real mixed tenure. It's all sorts of different people using it. So for those nurses or those guards that mightn't be on the income scale that would get you into social housing, they could go in there, and it's a lower cost because the land is cheaper, it's public land, and you don't have a developer's margin. Why is it not happening? I believe there's an innate conservatism within Fine Gael to think that the market is still the best way of solving this. And they've one example in Inchicore, St. Michael's Estate there, and that's trumpeted, and I very much welcome it, and I'd like to see it built as cost rental housing. But there should be 10 of those sort of developments. And they should be particularly, if you don't mind Deirdre saying, in our constituencies, in the centre of Cork, centre of Limerick, centre of Dublin. That's where the biggest problem is. That's where the rents are highest. And what Brendan Kenny, the head of Dublin City Council, says, we won't have any more social housing effectively in Dublin City Centre because we can't afford it. Well, we can if we got sites like Broadstone Bus Garage, which is a moment used to store, you can park buses. That's a perfect site to develop high quality, close to the centre social housing. And there are other sites, the Glass Bottle site. I'd like to see Cahalbrough Barracks. I'd like to build a new barracks outside on the edge of the city and use that as a cost rental housing site. It just needs a bit of leap of imagination and doing it differently. And the problem with Fine Gael, not only are the numbers behind what we need, it's 18,000 rather than 36,000, but it's going back to the old model, and this is a time when we should be changing the model.
But the Land Development Agency will be looking at that, Eamon, because I do agree with you. I would like to see more of that in my own constituency. As somebody who's just moved from the rental market into buying my first house.
We proposed this idea and we got a majority in the Dáil. It was almost 2 years ago. Nothing has happened since.
That is the role of the Land Development Agency, which was obviously only just established quite recently. So that is a move in that direction.
But we didn't need the land agency to land development agency.
Well, I suppose it's a system that's set up, and it's a process and it's a way of doing it that's open, that's transparent, that's governed, that's managing the money.
In response to what Eamon was saying there, that his suspicion that there is this innate conservatism that ultimately Fine Gael feels that the market is the answer here, and any move, any serious move towards cost rental, towards other models, is going to come up against that.
The Fine Gael, I suppose, ethos around this is that people should be able to rent or afford their own home, whether they decide to rent or whether they have to go into social housing or whether they want to buy a house. You know, I mean, certainly within the party, myself, I can speak for myself personally that, of course, there needs to be regulation into the market. You can't just rely on a market to provide all social and affordable housing and to make sure that everyone has a home.
Do you worry that might not be a feeling that's shared by everybody at senior level in your party?
What I would really like to see is, and I'm not here to defend policies of the past, right? I'm here to look into the future, to look forward, and I absolutely accept I'm here as a Fine Gael representative. But what I would really like to see is these type of ideas, yes, generated, yes, brought forward, but also how do we look into the future? How do we develop a right to housing, a right to shelter within our constitution, within our laws, so that this can't happen again?
Rory?
Yeah, the problem is that if you're saying you want to solve a situation, your starting point needs to be, do you have the right policies to solve that? And the problem is the government's landmark policy is rebuilding Ireland. Rebuilding Ireland, which I analysed and said at the time, is fundamentally flawed because it is over-reliant on trying to reboot the property speculative model of housing provision in Ireland, predominantly based on home ownership, which means huge indebtedness for people, a very small role of social housing, and a private rental sector that basically offers unaffordable, insecure housing. That is our housing model. And it has been in perpetual crisis for the last 30 years. And if you look at countries like Denmark and Austria, where they've much higher proportions of this idea that Eamon and I and others have put across, this idea of public affordable housing, cost rental housing, they have 30, 40% of their housing is provided that for that. People have long-term, secure, affordable accommodation. And there has been a reluctance to pursue something like that here. And it's very clear. And it's, we should be honest and straight. It's not just this government. There is the Department of Housing is a major problem. We have got our different institutions. Some local authorities don't want to pursue this. We need to see that we need to make this radical shift to this new form of public housing. And we need to look at like figures like saying we produced 27,000 social housing solutions last year. Like, that's completely misleading. 75% at least, three quarters, are just going to private landlords, as you said, not giving people, like, HAP should not be called social housing. People can be evicted from a HAP tenancy just like anyone else in the private rented sector. It's actually not social housing. And I think that if we look at the reality, we've one cost rental pilot, possibly two, that should be scaled up. We should be talking about the plan. Where is the plan to build 20,000 of these units next year, the year after? There's no affordable housing. We have a cool-on cooperative building 20, 30 affordable housing units. There's no affordable housing plan. And I think the government has been really just, it's been reliant on two things, saving the banks, which goes back to it, saving the banks, and not willing to make a radical change in policy to learn from countries where housing is actually produced for people and meets their need. And we need a national conversation as well. How do we look at housing? Is it to be an investment commodity or something that's provided for people on their need? And we need to look at the human right to housing as well.
Mary, in terms of, I mean, looking at the figures, I was looking at the Government Economic and Evaluation Service, that did that's the section of DEEPER, the Department of Expenditure and Reform, did a review of social housing spend and how Rebuilding Ireland was working out, basically. The figures in that are really, like, that figure, the 480 million for HAP and rent supplement that went on HAP and rent supplement just in 2018, that's up 47% since 2015. Like, by any measure,
and is projected to be 1 billion in two or three years' time.
If you, Mel Reynolds was projecting it forward to 2022 on this scale of growth, if it were to keep up at this.
$3 billion in total.
$1.7
billion. But cumulatively over those years, since I think 2018 to 2022, we're talking about €3 billion
euros of
state
money. We're talking about
Severn
Children's Hospital, is what we're talking
about. Going in, literally subsidising private landlords in this manner, which is an incredible way to waste your money, fritter away your money and not build.
I think as well, Patter, when you talk about HAP subsidising private landlords, what it's also doing is competing against other people who usually would use private rental accommodation, who don't qualify for social housing. So they are now up against essentially the government when they go to see a house with three bed semi or an apartment or whatever that they think that they can find. And I think another thing is, it just strikes me that we could have been having this conversation 2 years ago. We could have been having it 3 years ago. The figures, if anything, they're going the wrong direction. We still have roughly 10,000 people homeless. And even this morning, you know, I think Owen Murphy was on RT Radio this morning, kind of coming out very triumphant about the 4,251 social houses that were built last year. Almost half of those were built by charities and by the approved housing bodies, not by local authorities. And I think that's important, because when we have crises in this country, it seems a lot of the time that the voluntary sector has to step in, the charities have to step in. And as well, I picked up on one thing that he failed to say this morning, was he failed to tell us, and I know, Patter, you've done a bit of analysis saying roughly approximately 60 per local authority, but he couldn't give us how many of the 4,251 were built in each of the local authorities. And it kind of struck me, I was speaking to someone earlier, and the only way I could describe it is, I have a box of 50 apples. I tell you I have 50 apples in that box, but I haven't counted them. You have to count the apples in the boxes to know
the quarter three figures from the Department of Environment said that there was 833 local authority units built in the first three quarters of 2018. It suddenly jumps in the last quarter from 833 units to 2,200 units. I would actually ask, where did these units come from? Because there is a real issue about the numbers.
I think there is, yeah, I'm just going to let Mary in, but this issue, it's not just about the numbers, I think it's about the language around this, this business of referring to this as housing solutions, social housing units, even though, as you say, a lot of them are just private rental arrangements that could end at any moment.
I might just inject a note of caution into it in terms of the expenditure on HAP. It really does appear to be quite extraordinary, and the government has quite a record recently of overexpenditure on various different infrastructural projects. And I suppose that's the point that I would make, that in terms of giving the state responsibility for that kind of infrastructural project, you do need to have oversight, you know, very very transparent and accountable oversight in place. You need to have strong implementation models. You need to have a balance in terms of the extent to which political interference can be a factor in terms of the process. So I'm not saying that the state not building houses is something that should be considered, but I would make the point that there needs to be an infrastructure in place which supports that process in a way which is, you know, transparent and accountable.
Explain some of the benefits of cost rental, because the old model is the minister down in Customs House acts like Santa Claus, hands over a wad of cash to a local authority. It's often political. If there's any sort of downturn, it disappears, and we have this stop-start housing model. One of the advantages of cost rental is that either approved bodies or councils can borrow money because they know the cost is going to be covered by the rent over the next 20 years. And as that, it takes time. We have to think long-term in housing. It doesn't happen overnight. But over time, you build up an asset base, and it means you can keep borrowing through a downturn, and that the local authorities are not just always going cap in hand to the minister for the environment. So you get this long-term approach to housing that over, not just in the boom periods and the crisis periods, but in the downturn you're building, that's what you need. And that's one of the advantages of it. It takes time. It's not going to happen overnight. But it's the fact that they're not starting it. And there was a report, I think, by the National Economic and Social Council, God, it's almost 3 or 4 years ago, saying this was the way to go. And if they had kind of acted on that, said, okay, let's do this, we would now have half a dozen or a dozen such schemes, and you'd start to build up the lending capability and getting away from the old system, which was political patronage, cap in hand to the minister. Where the, and I think one of the reasons the department have kept it as it is they quite like it.
I was going to say,
they have control in that system.
They don't like the other system. Why would you see it
exactly
in that way?
And I think that's part of the problem.
I think part that the problem is that Fine Gael have an allergy to intervention into the market. They just have an allergy, and they'll dress it up and they'll spin it that it's not the case, but it's their instinct. It's their as you say, their economic conservatism in that regards. And, you know, I spoke to Michael Noonan when he was Minister for Finance in this, and he actually said the house prices weren't dear enough in this country. That's what he said, house prices had to increase in order to create supply. And an interesting thing what he did was he rolled out the red carpets to international investors in the housing market. So now these big international investors own about 350,000 properties, which is about 22% of the housing stock. So they, like the HAP renter, they are competing for stock against first-time buyers, and they're pushing up rents and house prices as well. And there's a massive transfer of wealth on a monthly basis now from renters to these international investors with no benefit to the market in the long term.
Are those international investors, though, just taking over whole apartment blocks that will never really be bought by a first-time buyer? And actually, because they're such an international entity, that they're probably better than your accidental landlord your single property landlord.
To a certain extent, what you're correct in, actually, now that big blocks of apartments are being sold en masse to these international investors, but the first-time buyers are not getting an opportunity to buy them. In years past, these would have been sold individually through estate agents, and first-time buyers would be competing for these at a reasonable rent. I think in 2015, something like 43% of the houses built in Dublin were actually consumed by these international property developers.
Just one other twist on that, if I can, as well. There are 1,000 apartments being built in the Docklands at the moment, about to be fulfilled. But it's not just the investors in it. I think 650 of them now are already subcontracted to some of the big international companies, you know, the international Facebooks and Googles. So even though they're going onto the market, they're not really going onto the market. And that's why, going back to what I said, it's the likes of what we can do in Dublin City Centre and Galway and Limerick and Cork. That's where the real tight supply problem is. And therefore, relying on the market, it's not just who the investor is, it's that the actual supply is going to certain companies and it leaves other people.
Yeah, and that's the problem with the whole, even the framing of social housing. And, you know, Owen Murphy coming out and saying, look, we're building these social housing which are inadequate, and, you know, the points that are not actually social housing. But it's not talking about who is providing the housing for those 20%, 30% in the rental market who have no prospect of buying their home, who are stuck paying these unaffordable rents in insecure tenancy. For the workers of the country, the average income, the whole point is, and this is the idea of cost rental housing, is it expands out social housing, that it should be available to anybody if they, do you know what I mean, in terms of if they need this housing, that it's not something that's just for the very low income. And because the problem is with the real estate investment trusts, any of the housing that's been built, or when they build it or buy it, is they push up the rents. Mm. They don't provide affordable housing. And this is the real failure that government and housing policy over the last kind of three decades has made, is that it is looking to the private sector to build affordable housing. The private sector doesn't build affordable housing. And in the context of a market with very high demand and low supply, the private sector just tries to get as much as it can out of it. So we need, who is going to supply the affordable housing? And it needs to come to the state, plus housing bodies, plus cooperatives, to take on and say, we're going to deliver not 2,000 units a year, but 20,000 units a year for a range of incomes. And that's how you solve this crisis.
I'm just looking at some of the text coming through to us here. Dublin housing policy is now to Heller to Connacht, to Heller to Connacht plan, with few affordable or public units available. Pathetic progress and landlords win. Another text from Kieran in Tralee. Government has a fixation that free market economics is the basis for providing all public services, including housing and health. And we have a tweet from Gordon. Prices of houses pumped by ECB inflation, rent pumped by HAP, vulture funds warping the housing market further, Airbnb being used as hotels, hotels being used as houses. Fine Gael housing policies are mighty altogether. Deirdre. Mm-hmm.
I just like to, what Rory was saying there about the housing policy and the housing system, because I actually agree with a lot of what you were saying. But I'm not convinced that we would be in a better situation, let's say in 12 months from now, if we just decided that the state would take on board to build all these houses. And I say that, for example, as somebody who lives in Cabra, which was built by the state, you know, a great place to live.
Why wouldn't we be?
But I don't think
we have guarantee.
I don't think we have the infrastructure right there, Rory. I mean, and this is what I mean. And you know, you're an expert in housing, you know this, but like that takes time.
It does.
And it takes what you're talking about. It takes systems, it takes governance, it takes transparency. So, you know, when we're putting solutions on the table here, I mean, Patter's talking about like, oh, we just need more money for social housing. But for what? Like, do you know what I mean? Like it needs to be.
But it's set out there. That, like there's very clear, and even like Owen Murphy has, you know, launched a cost rental programme. A pilot, a project in St. Michael's Estate. There's another one been developed in South Dublin. It's there. The model is there. We've known for it for years. It's about embracing it, saying, yeah, we're going to do this. Like, why shouldn't we be aiming? And when we say the state, we don't mean just local authorities. We mean a mix of local authorities, housing associations, cooperatives going, doing this. But the state has to say, we're actually going to deliver these.
Just
ensure they're delivered.
I think the state has a massive role in creating supply for sure. But it's not going to do everything. Obviously, you need to have a functioning private sector in this as well. Mm-hmm. I think your first tweet was really interesting there that to Held or to Connacht statement, because this type of housing policy that we see now at the moment is contributing to sprawl at the moment. We're seeing people now being forced out again into Ulster and Connacht and Munster from commuting areas into Dublin, which adds to the sustainability problem that we have environmentally in this country. So, you know, if we don't get the simple thing with regards to housing right, it's very hard to get the economy right, it's very hard to get the environment right, and it's impossible to get families' nutrition, mental health, education issues right as well. So it has to be tackled.
Okay, on that note, we will leave it there. We will take a break, but stay with us because we want to talk about political parties and their space on the political landscape after these.
Email latedebate@rte.ie.
And you're welcome back to Thursday's Late Debate. With me tonight in studio, we have Eamon Ryan and Pather Tobin, Deirdre Duffy, a Fine Gael election candidate, Mary C. Murphy from the Politics Department in UCC, Elaine Loughlin from the Irish Examiner, and Rory Hearn, lecturer in social policy with Maynooth University. Now, at Tuesday night's Fianna Fáil Parliamentary Party meeting, it was reported that Barry Cowan had a pop at TDs John McGuinness, Mark McSharry and Eamon O'Queeve for not towing the party line. John McGuinness spoke the next morning to Today with Sean O'Rourke.
Political parties are about democracy. They're about debate. And that is not happening at parliamentary party level.
John McGuinness there in the aftermath of that row at the Fianna Fáil Parliamentary Party meeting this week. But is there room for a multitude of views within our existing political parties? And indeed, are the views of all of the Irish public represented in the Houses of the Oireachtas? Pather Tobin, you left Sinn Féin following the recent referendum to repeal the Eighth Amendment because you felt you were being marginalised, I believe. That's what you said on the exit for being for holding pro-life views. So why did you feel the need to start a whole new party?
Well, the political system is broken in Ireland for a number of reasons. One, I think Ireland is very good at uniformity and it's very good at orthodoxy. So if you go back to the 1950s, Ireland was a very orthodox state with very little tolerance for different views. I think in 2019, we're entering a similar period, but the mirror image of that. So a very orthodox state with very little tolerance for different views. So right now, all the parties in the Dáil are on exactly the same space on a range of, let's say, social issues at the moment. And I would go to, we've had 29 public meetings around the country so far in a space of just about 2.5 months. And what people are saying to me is that they have nobody to vote for whatsoever. They say they're disenfranchised currently by the groupthink that happens in the political system in this country. They are completely unrepresented. People from a Fianna Fáil background, a Sinn Féin background, an SDLP background are saying that the leadership of their parties are not listening to the grassroots on these issues anymore, that they are doing damage to their core values in a range of different issues.
Okay, you're saying on these issues, but is it not the case that the issue that a lot of the people that are going to those public meetings are concerned about is the abortion issue?
Well, for sure, like there's obviously the abortion is a very serious issue for many people, and 34% of the population voted against the referendum, and about 20% of the yes voters would have disagreed radically with the extreme nature of the bill that we have there currently. But I'll give you another example of this. I had a discussion with a Fine Gael TD recently about a debate that happened on RTE about whether or not young people should be allowed to legally transition from one gender to another.
This is the very controversial prime time.
Yeah, now it's a very serious issue. And no matter what side of the debate
you're on, it's a very serious issue. Now, that, in that debate, there are people outside, some of them from the Labour Party, outside RTE's gates, literally with placards saying that Graham Linehan was a bigot for having his view and that he wasn't even entitled to have a different opinion to them, never mind articulated. Now, I spoke to Fine Gael TD and I said, what is your view on that particular issue? And he said, well, I agree with Graham. And I said, well, why don't you say it out loud? And he said, sure, you get the head taken off if you said that out loud in this country at the moment. And, you know, I believe in a liberal democracy where, you know, people with different views respectfully engage with each other in those different views. You know, opposition, respectful opposition is not the enemy of democracy. It's actually a key part of the functioning of democracy.
Deirdre, would you agree with that? That there is a sense that there are some views that are no longer allowed to publicly hold?
Well, I mean, I wish Pedder all the best, really, in his party. I think democracy is a good thing. I think voices are a good thing. I believe in human rights and plurality and all the rest of it. To be honest with you, I just don't really get the point, because it seems to me as though it's a party that's set up directly to oppose the abortion, women's access to healthcare around abortion. And we've had that debate in this country. We had it last year. It's been decided. We've had the legislation. We're moving on. I think
but
that
what
this
about
country...
the third of the electorate that voted against that? And you know, their view isn't going to change over.
No, but they don't have to have abortions. This is about women having access to healthcare. And we're not going to have this debate again. I know you're not saying that. But like, they do not need to access abortion. They do not need to perform abortions. And that's the debate, right? So in terms of the public opinion or whatever it might be, I mean, I just want to say the thing about the Graham Linehan thing, Padger, is because he was not an expert. That's why people were protesting, because they wanted expert voices on something that is very nuanced and complicated.
So in other words, you're saying in this new democracy, only experts are entitled to express their views?
No, absolutely not.
And that's the nonsense of it.
This was a programme about something different, okay? This man didn't necessarily have expertise. No, because I just like to finish the point here. And actually what happened, particularly this year, around the abortion referendum, which traditionally had been seen as this extremely divisive issue, which we had kind of known for years it wasn't, was the fact that we managed to have open and respectful discourse. I'm just off the doors tonight in Dublin Central, and people disagreed with me on the abortion issue, and that's fine. And we managed to speak to each other respectively. We do it all the time. Well, see, so to say that now, we're shutting down society
it's
frankly just incorrect.
Well what I'm saying to is, if you talk to people, they feel that there's a new censorship. They feel there's a new political correctness in this country. They say that if you step outside of that, people are saying that they're actually censoring themselves and in their place of work, in their schools, in their education space. And, you know, if you believe in a liberal democracy, you should abhor that. You should actually say that even though your view is completely different to mine, I will fight for your right to be able to respectfully articulate it. Now,
I would say we should all agree to do something about public education.
Now, you mentioned about Graham Linehan not having a right to have a view because he wasn't an expert on the issue.
On the particular programme.
If we are going to reduce democratic discourse to experts, we're actually it's incredible. The Dáil would not be able to have a conversation about any of these issues if we're just to be reduced to experts. Every single citizen in this country has a right to be able to form an adult view with regards what these issues are, to do it respectfully and responsibly. Now, what I would say to you is this: if you suppress views that are dearly held by a large number of people on a range of different issues, it's very dangerous. One, because you don't have the ability for these people to rigorously test the establishment. And two, you will push these people towards the margins, where you'll find that people who are far less responsible will actually use...
But what are the range of different views, Peter, beyond abortion?
I'll tell you.
I would say the other thing about dissing experts, if you're a legislator in the House, you are, of course, an expert on making legislation. Please do not bring us down the Brexit route, where we're starting to really dumb down and not listen to people who have the medical expertise to talk about things. What are the other issues?
Well, if Padder's claim of that, you know, we're putting a censor on democracy here and public discourse, to take the Graeme Linehan argument again, we wouldn't know what Graeme Linehan thinks now because he wouldn't have been able to make his views clear. But we're all talking about what he had to say because he was given that space to say it. And the Fine Gael politician who you were talking about, I don't know who he or she was, but I think that's probably the politician's fault if they were that, I suppose, if they had that belief and that opinion and it was so great within themselves, then they would have and should have spoken out. And okay, some people may have disagreed with them, but they would have been heard, and that is democracy.
Okay, I just want to read a couple of texts in here. There's a tweet from Cormac McKay in Dublin. Politicians are out of touch with the general public, and after the success of the Citizens' Assembly, we need more participatory say that with a mouthful of marbles, direct democracy. Katie, this is a text. Katie, I fully agree with Pádraig Tobin. There is no difference between Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael anymore, and with no opposition and intolerance of alternative views. We have a 21st century version of censorship in modern day politically correct Ireland. That's from Edward in Dublin. I'm going to ask Eamon, do you get that sense that there are particular views that if you express them, there's a sort of a pile on top of you? I'm thinking in spaces like, say, social media, Twitter in particular, which would be more supportive of liberal opinion than conservative opinion, I think it's safe to say. And there are some pretty ugly scenes if somebody dares to...
Well, write about direct provision and you'll see that that's not necessarily the case. Write about some other social issues and you'll see that it's not just liberals that are on Twitter. There's a lot of conservative views out there and quite
on
nasty
both sides,
views as well.
So on both sides. On both sides, there is a lot of illiberal comment on, sure, on social media, and it has facilitated it. I agree with Pádraig in a way, in that I think there probably are people who outside their field there that there may be, you know, that there are certain issues that now are taboo or that it's hard to express certain opinions. But I'm not too sure if our political system is completely broken in the way that he describes. I do think, and I think I said it to you privately, Pádraig, in terms of, I mean, I think Sinn Féin made a mistake personally, and there were other parties, ourselves included, small number of people who would have had different views in that referendum. And I think I'd like to think that there's space within parties for different views. We have 10 different political groupings in the Dáil. There's all sorts of opinions there. They're not necessarily shy, a lot of the people in it. So I don't think we've completely restricted debate within our political system. I do think we have to be careful that we maintain an open and respectful dialogue for different views in our society. And I think that applies to both sides of the argument.
Rory?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that it's true that there are a significant proportion of people who feel excluded. And obviously we're seeing this not just in Ireland, but across, you know what I mean, across Europe and the States. You know, there are major social issues where people feel, you know, there's still a lot of disadvantaged communities, people who have, you know, are still in mortgage arrears, who absolutely, tens of thousands of people have been left living for almost a decade in mortgage arrears, feel no one represents them. You know, you've got the whole cost of living, childcare, the housing crisis. And in the last election, there was as many people didn't vote as voted for Fine Gael. There is a lot of people out there who do not feel represented. But the question then for those who are in politics or who want to represent or have a mood for change or bring about social change and represent a different view is, what vision are you offering? And what type of politics are you offering? Because we have seen there's one type of politics being offered, you know, in other countries like Brexit or the far right, which is turning and blaming immigrants and trying to turn that anger to blame. And as we as described on social media, is punching down on those below who are less vulnerable. And there's other people who take a different view, like Corbyn or Sanders in the States, who are, you know, offering a different type of progressive, open society, but is about equality and is about trying to give people a proper quality of standard living. And I think the big issue, one big issue is the problem is a divided left in Ireland, that you have too many small left parties and too many parties on the left. And so people go, well, where is the coherent opposition? Where is this alternative to Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael? And they can't see it. And that's a challenge.
Okay, Mayor, we talked about experts there. This is your area of expertise. I mean, the political landscape has become much more fragmented here than it would have been, say, 20, 30 years ago. Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
Oh, I think it's absolutely a good thing. We've definitely seen, as you said, Eamon, 10 political groupings in Dáil Éireann now, which is quite a contrast with previous decades. And we've got a much broader spectrum of opinion as well represented within the Dáil. But the Irish electorate is, for the most part, broadly to the centre-right. And that produces the type of party system that we have, and that produces the type of political sentiment and ideology which guides Fine Gael and other political parties in terms of major public policy issues. So what we're seeing in that context is, you know, parties which are... These parties reflect public sentiment. The extent to which there's a space for a new political party or a new political movement, you know, I suspect there is some space for that, and it probably is to the right of the political spectrum. And we are seeing some emerging trends in terms of, you know, the abortion issue as a social issue, mobilising people to a certain extent. The immigrant issue is actually not something which seems to mobilise Irish people to the same extent as it does in other European countries. So there is a space of sorts within the broader party system for that kind of sentiment to emerge, but it's nevertheless still very, very challenging in terms of trying to capture that. So there's huge hurdles to be mounted in terms of actually getting to that space.
Can I make a point, Katie? We had our own leader, European leader, over last week, and we had a series of debates on Brexit and other issues. He was citing the British political system, the first past the post, and America the same, for being central to a lot of their problems. They can't afford to kind of split now, even with the Labour Tories, and as a result they're trying to hold together parties where there are people of diametrically different views, and it's fundamentally broken. We're lucky with our PR system. But the other point you made, and I think this goes back, there is a core problem, as Rory said, in a sense, a lot of people may be afraid, disenfranchised or not, you know, and they also feel disillusioned with the old story, which was a kind of a me-based, the market will sort you out, individual, look after the individual motives. And people don't trust that anymore. After the crash, they kind of don't believe in that looking after yourself way of going forward. The problem is that we've replaced it with one form of we politics. But it's a problem because it's we which sees others as the problem. We see the migrants as the problem, or we see the cosmopolitan urban elite as the problem. We need a new form of politics, which is a we politics, which isn't just relying on the old me market politics, but which is not at the expense of denigrating someone else. And that's a tricky thing to do, but I think that's where we need to go.
And
a
it's
new
entirely
story
the opposite direction, though, from where politics has gone, if we look towards continental Europe, if we look look across the Atlantic.
We should try and avoid that. We should try and avoid that.
I just want to move on to the project that you have launched, that you've embarked upon. We saw what happened with Renewa. you know, and that started out with an even, you know, in some ways more promising start in terms that they had five Oireachtas representatives before on day one. And that party fell away, obviously. One election, it's still there, it's still getting public funding, but has no Oireachtas representation. And I know you've said, as I read that piece that you did with Harry McGee in the Irish Times this week, that no single TD will get elected on the back of the pro-life vote. And yet, according to Harry McGee's account, the majority of people who come to your public meetings because of your pro-life position.
The difficulty I have with Harry's analysis on that is there's a difference between an engine of a political party and the reason why people vote for them. So in other words, for Sinn Féin, for example, one of the engines would be a United Ireland. But they very seldom go to a door in a local election or even in a general election and say, vote for the candidate because that candidate wants a United Ireland. They will go to the door and fight on the bread and butter issues, the hierarchy of needs issues, the housing, the healthcare, all of these things that people need. But the reason why people get emotionally invested in that organisation is because their strong desire to see Irish unity. And in many ways, AIM2 would have, obviously, we seek the unity of the Irish people as well. We're obviously focused on creating economic justice. I don't see, like, the difference between ourselves and Renew are radical in that we're an all-Ireland party for a start. We're left of centre economically. You know, the experience that people have had with regards to the abortion debate just recently is a far more invasive experience than people had in 2013. There were hundreds of thousands of people marching. There were tens of thousands of people in the lashings of rain putting up posters, leafleting, canvassing. And there were 700,000 people with their hearts radically broken after voting in that referendum. So the experience of those people are completely different.
But you haven't been able to attract a single TD or senator?
Well, first of all,
what we have done
for a start is we've gone to 29 counties. We've had over 4,500 people attend those meetings so far. We've hundreds of people joining on a weekly basis. We've 9 elected reps from across the country at local government level who have currently joined us. People have left Fianna Fáil, the SDLP and independent positions to join with us. And our difference from Rainua is that we're trying to build a grassroots activist-based organisation. We've Cumann opening up every single night across the country now. And I believe it's actually from that grassroots activism. And that's what we're trying to change. Most of the political parties now have become this centralised top-down structure where they do have the infrastructure of democracy inside in the parties, but most of them ignore that infrastructure now. You can see that with Fianna Fáil, with regards to the Eighth Amendment, and with regards to their Ardèche desire to stand candidates in the north of Ireland, where Micheál Martin year after year basically tells the Fianna Fáil people to get stuffed. So we're trying to build that, where we want a situation where the grassroots are steering and developing the organisation and are building the organisation around the country.
I think part of the problem with that though is in Ireland it's quite a unique political system because of the large number of independents that we have. So a lot of that type of sentiment can actually get channeled and represented by that larger number of independent TDs. So it makes the whole process of creating a political party, a new political party, that little bit more challenging, I think, because of that particular context.
Yeah, Deirdre.
Yeah, just a slight aside, I suppose. We have local and European elections coming up as well. And when we're talking about politics, I do think we need to talk about that. I was just at a Women's Council event today and they're trying to get a lot more women engaged in it and looking for gender issues and signing up to gender manifestos. But if I can, and I might be completely biased in this, I do think that one of the ways for new politics is more women. And that's certainly one of my main drivers. You're talking about the engine there, Padraig, for myself. And you look at your colleague, Catherine Martin with the Women's Caucus and things like that. And it's working across the parties. And instead of having more fragmentation, what I'd actually like to see is debate and discussion on policy and on values and principles, yes, like we did there in housing, but more unity around moving forward together, which is what the parties did on huge social issues like abortion. And Rory, you're saying there about the left, I agree with you. And that was one of the huge successes of our campaign, the fact that the left was united around a single cause, around repealing the Eighth. One of the questions I would have for Padraig then is, you know, what are the fundamental issues upon which your party differs to that of Sinn Féin, because I don't really see them. And like, that would seem to me, if I was strategically looking at forming a new party, which I am not, I would be thinking, okay, where's my unique selling point? Where's my strategy? Where am I coming in differently, rather than fragmenting, when we should really be trying to build unity in order to solve these big, huge, complex problems like the housing one that we were talking about? So what is different?
Well, I suppose obviously one of the big differences will be the lack that we won't have the same rigidity as Sinn Féin has with regards to its membership and elected reps. And that's one of the problems that Sinn Féin is having. And that's why they're seeing so many elected reps leave them over the last number of years. With regards, if you look at the Sinn Féin housing document at the moment, there's very little of anything written around private supply of housing. It's all public supply of housing. Well, I'm a big fan of public supply of housing, but there's two sides to this coin that have to be dealt with. With regards to the north of Ireland, The North is now seeing its third budget being implemented from Westminster at the moment. It's a form of direct rule, yet all of the political parties are fully focused on just bringing back Stormont under the original guise that was in. We believe that while the Good Friday Agreement was a wonderful agreement, we have to move beyond the Good Friday Agreement now at this stage, because, you know, bringing back the Stormont under the previous arrangement is guaranteed to make it fail again.
Can I ask a question with regard to that? Because we had our conference in Northern Belfast last Saturday, Green Party Northern Ireland, we're an all-island institution. And our leader there, Claire Bailey, was very clear, saying she thinks Sinn Féin is making a fundamental mistake in demanding a border poll now. It's actually the epitome of that we versus ye politics. And what she said is, it's border poll now would be just another Brexit Mark II. You'll be going into a referendum where you don't know the result, where you're likely to divide, where it would be, you have to prepare for that. You have to set out a vision for New Ireland. You have to understand what you're voting for. Mm-hmm. No one knows that at the moment. I'd prefer to see the institutions restored and reformed. Do you think Sinn Féin are right to call for a border poll now?
Well, what I would say is what we're seeing in London and Dublin is exactly the same attitude as the Conservatives had when they called the Brexit referendum. We see absolutely no planning for the potential of United Ireland at all. I would suggest we should have an All-Ireland Constitutional Convention at this stage to actually start to tease out what exactly that an All-Ireland, a United Ireland would look like. What are going to be the challenges? What kind of constitution will be necessary to deal with such a situation? I think, you know, the idea of, you know, not building the All-Ireland economy, very little has been done with it over the last number of years, and the government should be building it. It's one of the best ways to ameliorate the worst threats of Brexit coming up.
Okay, very quickly, because I do want to get on to broadband
Mary. Just in terms of that idea of a constitutional convention, I totally agree with Eamon. Preparation is key in terms of having a referendum of this nature. But there's no point having a constitutional convention on the island unless you have buy-in from all communities. Well, and that includes unionists in Northern Ireland. And the suggestion that unionists in Northern Ireland are ready for that kind of conversation now, it's misleading and it's unfair.
The only worry I have, if you look at polls currently, there's a Clareburne poll which said 87% of the South wanted to see United Ireland in a worst-case Brexit scenario. Right now, in the north of Ireland, it's nearly 50-50 with regards to that. Now, the union is built upon majoritarian rule, and yet, even if that majoritarian rule changes, you're suggesting that the union shouldn't be changed.
The extent to which those figures can be entirely trusted, the extent to which they're even credible, is undermined by the fact that they're being elicited in a complete vacuum, because there is no sense about what exactly that vote would entail. What kind of new Ireland are you talking about when you put that
into
to people?
Is saying that we should be planning right now. We should actually be talking to people right across. I did a report on the All-Ireland economy a number of years ago. I spoke to hundreds of people with regards to that. Everybody said, no matter what background they were from, if we plan together, if we fund together and deliver services together, they will be better services irrespective of the constitutional arrangements.
Now is different,
and that's
though.
What we need to be
people
doing.
People are worried about Brexit.
Okay, Deirdre, I'm going to just stop that debate there, because we just have a few minutes left and I want to touch briefly on the broadband issue. 540,000 premises around the country still waiting for high-speed broadband. We're still waiting for the government decision on whether to award the contract to the last remaining bidder, National Broadband Ireland. And today, of course, the key broadband providers were before the Public Accounts Committee and we were hearing about more potential risks to the rollout of this. Eamon Ryan, you were Minister for Communications. You promised broadband everywhere by 2012, I believe.
We delivered a national broadband plan on time, on budget. Okay, it wasn't as fast as it would be now, but we actually delivered it. It's not an easy thing to do. I think we need it. We need to go further now. We need to get fibre to every home. I think the key thing now in my mind, there are two ways we could do it, it seems to me. One would be use the telephone poles. There are 2 million of them out there. But we also have electricity poles. And we know now you can wrap fibre around electricity lines. Mm-hmm. One of the ways of getting competition into the final stage of this very messy and messed up bidding process is to ask ESB and AIR to bid together or bid against each other to see. Because I think it doesn't make sense. Think 20, 30 years. Do we want two poles going to every house? I'd prefer to see one.
But
I think the ESB ones are probably the better ones to do it.
Eamon, we're talking about fibre, saying it was discussed at the Public Accounts Committee today, this issue of the National Broadband Plan, which we're still waiting on. It was actually Pat Rabbit that we have to go back to that announced the National Broadband Plan in 2012. That's how long this plan has been knocking about. And obviously we've seen a lot has happened in the world of online and all the rest since 2012. And fibre, which we're still talking about, is now out of date. That's what we heard.
That's
what we heard at the PAC today.
Yeah,
the people are going for...
They know it.
Well, they're going for the rollout of fixed wireless at the moment.
And I think that's you need fibre. The people I trust are really... Susan Crawford over in the States, the best academic this area, she says we still need fibre.
And all the tenders that were submitted as well also said that from all the different companies.
Because they were tendered at a certain point in time, and now companies have moved forward and they're going with this wireless solution.
I think what we know at this stage is probably the National Broadband Plan is toast. The fact that it is far too cumbersome, it's far too slow. The technology is moving at a different pace than the state is able to actually process.
You, as you say that, Patrick, I could see people right around the country going, oh my God,
first of all, the procurement process that you would have it in such big blocks is built to fail. I believe that the procurement process should have happened in a far smaller process, less complex. One of the reasons why AIR originally left the process because they said it was too complex. Another company left because they said there was no commercial benefit in it. We're actually tied up by these ridiculous European rules which say the state has to build the infrastructure, then hand it over to a private company, and then subvent that private company to deliver back to people. And there needs to be a tailored solution to different areas in the country. There's some parts of rural Ireland that will have an imagined solution which will be a fixed wireless, and there will be some parts of the country which will be better suited to fibre.
But is the more prudent thing now just to let literally keep the bread in the bag and to kind of let it run its course rather than toasting it?
But there's one company
left. Because the reality is it's nearly there. I was kind of stretching it a bit on that. But anyway, the minister is making a decision shortly and is looking at governance, is assessing the single tender process. So what is the point in ditching that?
Can I briefly come in that? Because people are talking about the National Children's Hospital at the moment. Yet when you ask how much broadband is going to cost, they say between 1.5 billion and 3 billion. The gap in that space is phenomenal, and it in itself is another crisis.
And I just want to pick up on one point there, Deirdre, because you actually have said what several ministers have now been saying, that the tender will be announced or decided shortly. That's the stock answer that we've been getting for months and months and months now, and it's still shortly, and into 2019.
I remember going back years ago, Seamus Brennan, I was shadowing him, and he was a very smart minister. He'd always ask the question, when is the due, minister? Within weeks. He would never tell you how many weeks. It could be 52 weeks, it could be 4 weeks. Weeks was always the answer.
But I think it's an issue around, and I wrote about public-private partnerships in a book 10 years ago and critiquing this whole over-reliance on the way in which the over-reliance on the private, this private outsourcing approach, this contracting that has major flaws. And we've been at it now for this 20 years, public-private partnerships that Taoiseach was talking about in the Dáil again. It's how we'll deliver housing. There's this, a dysfunctional approach within our state towards how we're delivering our key infrastructure. Mm-hmm. And it is based on essentially the state not doing it and just trying to contract it from the private sector. And so it's constantly a knot.
Well, it's about the management of risk. I presume that's the basis of all of that.
The management of risk. The state has to accept, right, that it needs these things delivered, the hospital, housing, roads. So we take on the risk. But that means you don't try and spend so much time with figuring out how the private sector will take on that risk. You give them a very clear contract specifically of what they have to do. We pay for it, and we do it ourselves as well as the state. But the whole approach of this contracting, outsourcing, that is all about how do we get the private sector to take on the risk? It costs too much and it doesn't work.
Mm. Okay, we're going to have to leave it at that. Just a couple of headlines. The Times Ireland tomorrow goes with UK retreats on backstop as May loses vote again. And there's another headline there. Touch of God goes contactless. Churches accept credit card payments. The Irish Examiner is going with prison service spent €20,000 on spying. The Guardian is the Theresa May story again. Another Brexit vote for May, another humiliation. I want to thank you for listening. I want to thank my panel. Tonight's programme was produced by Penny Hart. Research was by A.B. Philbin Bowman. The broadcast coordinator was Emily Hurley, and Richard McCullough was on sound. Now it's over to Colin Murray on Late Date.